Can you think of like a funny little secret we could use sometime to open the show with?
I actually thought about this.
Okay. Oh, great.
I'm a big listener of the show, so I thought about this.
Cool.
Yeah, so I had a job where there was summer Fridays. Mm-hmm. And so on summer Fridays, not that many people came into the office, but this particular Friday, I decided to come into the office. So I came in and I was working, and it gets to be that after lunchtime and I was super tired. So I decided I wanted to take a nap in my office, but I decided I wanted like a really comfortable nap. So I went out into the hallway of my office and I found this couch, and I took the couch cushions and I brought them into my office and I laid them down on the floor and I took a nap. And so I napped for like 45 minutes, an hour, and I woke up and then I tucked the cushions back and I went back around my day. And then about 15 minutes later, my boss and his secretary come upstairs, and the secretary screams, "The cushions! The cushions, they're back! They're back! Where did they come from?" And it turns out that they had spent like the whole time I was asleep looking for the cushions to this couch, thinking that somebody had stolen them. And they like scoured the whole office. They looked outside. They thought like a homeless person had snuck into the building to like take them. And they were just like, and then when they appeared again, like, they thought it was a ghost or something.
It was a scandal.
Like,
they didn't suspect you at all.
So they didn't suspect me at all. I was just napping on them in my office.
Thank you for sharing that.
No problem.
Today's episode contains a couple scenes that describe sexual assault. My guest handles the events with some humor. You should decide if this episode is right for you.
I've never seen like a soldier in action before. And so I wasn't really prepared for just like the sheer physicality he suddenly snapped into.
Today, a woman tells me about her youthful sojourn in Tel Aviv.
Wow, what a life.
Yeah, it was really weird.
Yeah.
But weird hardly captures what she saw.
I walked into the kitchen and the bar owner, Ari, was just beating the living shit out of some poor soul.
Good Lord.
The people she met.
And it turns out Yosef is super into artificial intelligence. And I was like, what the what?
Or what she experienced.
So there was one night where a knife fight broke out in my section.
It's a tale of flight, danger, inner turmoil, and yes, love of a sort.
He'll protect me from anything, and he can.
Right.
And he's ferocious. He's fierce, you know?
Yeah.
Today, The Secret Room presents It Happened in Tel Aviv.
Hi, my name is Marie. My secret is a bad decision I made one night when I was a 21-year-old dipshit working at a bar in Tel Aviv, and it had terrible consequences. It happened 20 years ago, Ben, and I'm ready to tell the story.
I'm Ben Hamm. Hi, Marie. Welcome to The Secret Room.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So your secret took place several years ago in a city far, far away, right?
Yes, it did. Once upon a time, far, far away.
Yeah. Can you tell me where and when?
So this was in Tel Aviv, Israel, and it was in 2001. The backdrop of the story is the Second Intifada and 9/11, oddly. I arrived in Tel Aviv on September 10th, 2001, which was very surreal.
The day before 9/11.
The day before 9/11, yeah.
And the Second Intifada, of course, is a Palestinian uprising against Israel.
Absolutely.
And that was like 2000 for a few years.
Yep.
And so you were there a year into that.
Yes, I was, yeah.
Before you found yourself in Tel Aviv, what were you doing in the U.S.? What were you up to? Studying?
I was studying. I was in med school, actually. I was studying neuroscience and artificial intelligence back before it was cool. And I studied with, we didn't have machine learning back then. No, it was artificial neural networks, and I was kind of passionate about it.
Well, we didn't even have iPhones then.
No, we did not have iPhones. If we'd had iPhones, then my whole story might not have ever happened.
Right. Well, okay, interesting. So, yeah, tell me some more about your studies.
I think like a lot of people who have interesting, chaotic stories, I came from an interesting, chaotic childhood with just lots of death and trauma and abuse and terror. And it's actually kind of, it's almost run of the mill for some of your storytellers.
Oh, gosh.
But the thing is that the chaos, that what they call the chaotic childhood, it's kind of a euphemism, but I was really good at it. I was really good at hiding problems from those around me, and I was really good at school, and I was excelled at my studies, and I actually got into med school when I was 17.
And was your plan to be a doctor?
Yeah, my plan was to be a doctor and a neuroscientist. I kind of had that path all laid out for me when I entered college.
But then something happened. You made a decision to go to Tel Aviv. Was that for study abroad?
No, decision is such an interesting word to use.
Okay. Why on earth did you decide to go to Tel Aviv?
The answer is I didn't decide. Turns out for people who are really good at chaos, sometimes folks like that are really bad at safety and predictability. And, you know, the utter normality of my dorm room and my life there, it turned out to be incredibly stressful. I didn't have any like conception of what was happening, but I basically had a kind of meltdown. The transition from adolescence to adulthood doesn't always go great, and mine did not go well. And I had basically a full-life meltdown, stopped going to class, kind of got to the point where it was becoming difficult to hide how much distress I was in. And so I just fled the country, basically, is what happened. Yeah.
I know your story is not about that part in your life.
Yeah.
But since you brought it up.
Sure. Yeah.
Can you tell me what the stress was in your life?
Yeah. Well, I belong to a club that I call the Crazy Moms Club. And I like to think of it like a bingo card where every square has something in it. Like, have you ever picked your mom up off of the floor? Like, have you ever called 911 on your mom? You know, and you have to cross off all of them. And I think if you get a line of five in a row, your prize is crippling intimacy issues for decades to come. So mm-hmm. I think having a very, very mentally ill mother, and my father was shot and killed when I was very young.
Oh my
so.
Gosh.
Yeah, so I just didn't have, safety, predictability, and regularity in my home. And, you know.
And so.
Hijinks ensued.
And you decided to seek yeah. some level of chaos just in another country.
Yeah, and I wasn't aiming for Israel at all.
Okay.
I was aiming for St. Petersburg because I'd been studying Russian. But you know how it is when you're a kid and you're traveling through Europe and you get sidetracked and you meet people and you go where they're going.
How did you end up leaving school for this trip?
In the dark of night. It was a drop the mic and walk out kind of situation. I didn't tell anyone.
Really? You just left everything behind?
I just left everything. I just dropped and ran. I was in a mental meltdown.
Friends, family, adios.
Exactly. Yeah.
You just got a plane ticket and a URL pass and you were like, I'm heading to Europe.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Okay.
And, you know, I landed in Prague and I was headed to St. Petersburg, but I met some other kids who were heading to Israel and I fell in with the wrong sort of crowd.
Wow, amazing. And so
yeah.
The wrong crowd, those were the other kids that you met up with?
The people who were traveling to Israel during an intifada were often people who were fleeing various sorts of things. And so there were a lot of people who had overstayed their visas, who were like fleeing minor charges back home. And, you know, the travelers that were in that set were a pretty seedy sort. And I was one of them. So I was fleeing too.
And so what exactly was appealing about going to Israel at this particular moment in time?
Well, I was almost out of money, and the people I was traveling with assured me that it was really cheap right now, which makes sense because of the whole, you know, war zone thing.
Right. So you made a calculation that the danger was worth the savings.
You know, calculations were not in my mindset at that time. I had friends. They were going somewhere. I went with them. That's about as much logic as there was to my decision making back then.
I got it. All right.
Yeah.
You end up in Tel Aviv,
mm-hmm.
and How much money do you have with you when you get there?
God, I can't remember. Here's the thing. My decision-making was so poor at the time that I wasn't even checking my bank balance. I just knew that I was in Tel Aviv when the ATM stopped giving me money.
And it stopped giving you money because your balance got to zero.
Yeah, it got to zero. Yeah. So I just didn't have any money left. And so I couldn't leave, but I also kind of didn't want to, because all of a sudden I was in chaos again, and it sort of made sense to me.
Can you describe the chaos you found yourself in?
Yeah. First of all, it's a nation just almost entirely, or at least back then when I was there. I don't want to speak on behalf of a nation, but the crowd that I ran with and the people that I encountered, everybody basically had PTSD to some degree or another, right? It was a place that was extremely traumatized, where there was like gunfire and bombs and death and destruction. And I was like, I'm home.
Wow.
Like, it felt very comfortable to me in ways that I can kind of understand now, but I didn't comprehend it all at the time. At the time, it all just felt like me following the wind that was blowing me around.
You can understand now how being in a war zone felt comfortable?
Yeah, I can now, but at the time I was just like, oh, I guess I'm out of money. Let's see what happens next.
Okay.
I felt safer in the war zone than I did in that dorm room. And that's just some deep dysfunction right there, but that's what it is.
Just to get an idea of, you know, what it was like in Tel Aviv then, would you say that you were exposed to war events like bombings and shootings, gunfire on a daily basis?
Yes and no. There were incidents, like I said, waking up to gunfire because the bomb squad was exploding a bomb in the street. You know, definitely the easy facility that with violence that everyone around me had. It wasn't until actually after I left that people that I knew started to get killed. When I was there, it was a backdrop that it was surprisingly easy for me to ignore.
Right. Yeah. It was a year into the Intifada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about a year in.
It lasted like 5 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, gosh. Okay. So, you know, back to that ATM.
Yeah. Okay. Right?
Back to the ATM.
Yeah.
It's coming up zero. And you're like, well, you know, that must have been a wake up moment for you when your card comes back with zero. Okay.
You would think.
Okay. But it was not.
No. You would think it would be a wake up moment, but not exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So you're a survivor. Had you been working up until that point, or was this a point where you said, well, I got to find a way to get some money?
Yeah, that was exactly it. I was like, I got to find a way to get some money.
Okay.
And I didn't really know exactly how to go about it.
All right. So, well, but ultimately you did. So what steps did you take, you know, to rectify this situation?
Well, the first thing that I did was I started doing day labor and like that sort of semi-legal labor work. We have that in this country, but it was a lot more common over there at that time.
So is that like, you know, laying bricks or...
Yeah, it was. Sometimes I was cleaning up after a bombing. Oh, sometimes gosh. It was really variable, actually. It was just like you know, you'll see crowds of dudes hanging out in front of Home Depot, and a truck will pull up and load a bunch of them in and take them to a site. It was just like that.
Okay, and so you know, you're navigating a foreign city, and you found yourself in a place where you didn't speak Hebrew.
No, I didn't speak a word of Hebrew.
Yeah. So how did you figure out where to go? How to get paid, you know, all these kinds of things that are just second nature in, you know, the country you grew up in.
I fell in with the crowd that showed me how, and it was a hostel, and it was full of the people who hung out at the hostel where I could sometimes afford a bed and sometimes couldn't when I first arrived. They were often, like I said, they were expatriates with kind of like vaguely criminal backgrounds.
Vaguely.
Or a lot of times soldiers would come and hang out there. And I was in the hostel common room drinking beer with these folks and told them I was out of money. And they were like, yeah, come on a job with us tomorrow.
Okay, good. So you've got a network of people that are helping guide you to day labor.
Yes. Yeah.
Hostels, you know, food, whatever, you know, helping you figure out how to get your daily necessities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got a small income coming in. Now you said sometimes you could afford a bed at the hostel and sometimes you couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you end up on the evenings that you could not afford a bed at the hostel?
On the beach, you know, there was, it was right on the Mediterranean and the weather was decent.
Okay.
And it didn't feel, I look back now and I think, oh God, poor kid. But at the time I didn't experience it that way. I was just doing what was in front of me and dealing with what was in front of me.
You know, this is such an extreme lifestyle that you are painting for us. I can't even imagine living that way. And, you know, it's the reality that you found yourself in. Was there ever a point during this part of your story where you're like laying on the beach or, you know, waiting for a day labor job where you're just like, what the hell have I done? I need to get my ass back home to college and become a neuroscientist.
That's a good question. I think the simplest way to put it is that I was sufficiently broken that I didn't have like a contiguous sense of reality of like, I am in Tel Aviv. I am away from my life plan. To put that kind of logic on it doesn't actually fit what I was experiencing at the time.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to make that point to me because I feel now I've asked this question probably too many times. I'm just so astounded.
No, it's fine.
And I get what you're saying. I do. It just sounds, you know, just amazing. And my heart goes out to you because, you know, you didn't have a sense for the danger you were putting yourself in.
None whatsoever. No.
Yeah. Okay.
No, and I think to the extent that I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, all big cities are dangerous. There's crime everywhere, you know.
Okay.
To the extent that I thought about it, really, it was really self-justifying thoughts. We call it motivated reasoning.
So can you tell me about the first morning you woke up to gunfire and what you thought?
Yeah, I was in a hostel.
Living on a Mediterranean beach is one thing. But the harsh reality of just where Marie has found herself becomes ever starker as we continue. Marie opens the second chapter of It Happened in Tel Aviv, telling us about the first time she woke to gunfire.
Yeah, I was in a hostel, and I found out later that, again, like I said before, the bomb squad was exploding a vehicle in the middle of the street. And what they do is they kind of clear the block and then they just shoot at it. And I experienced this a number of times, some more comical than others. But in this case, I had never experienced warfare and organized crime life and all of the other kinds of violence that I was exposed to. So I just about hit the roof. I woke up in a panic and I ran out of my room down to the hostel common room and everyone was just sitting there watching TV. Huh. And I was like, oh, and that experience kind of normalized it for me. Like nobody blinked an eye. They were like, what? Oh yeah, no, stupid bomb scare. It's probably nothing.
Wow.
I'm like, okay.
All right.
Automatic gunfire is just part of your life.
Gosh.
I guess it's part of mine now too.
Yeah. So people weren't ducking, worrying that maybe a stray bullet might come in.
Not at all.
Huh.
Nope. Nobody changed their behavior whatsoever.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing to talk about now, but I just, you know, it was like a childlike quality. You know how like a 2-year-old child just accepts what's going on around them and like, oh, this is reality now. This is what reality is like. It was sort of like that I just took it all in and adjusted my expectations according to what other people around me were doing.
Well, humans have an amazing capacity to adapt to the environment they're in. And I think
they really do.
I think this is an extreme example of that.
Yeah.
Make do with what you have.
I know. And I don't want to make it more extreme than it was. It's not like I was on the front lines of the conflict and you know, was witnessing death every day. It wasn't like that. You know, I was in a city that was really violent.
I appreciate that contrast you draw, but I also don't want to diminish, you know, the dangerous environment you were in.
But diminishing my experiences is what I do best. You're denying me one of my great talents.
That's good. So what was it like being a woman in this environment?
Oh, God, it was so surreal. One of the things that people notice about me right away in this country is that I am like gargantuan. I'm almost 6 feet tall. I'm kind of built like a linebacker. And people look at me and they see a large person here. But they didn't exactly go to that right away in the Middle East, because the mental image of a female is meek and small and malleable. That mental image was so much more powerful than the evidence of the senses that I have a strong body, that people often perceived me as really, really weak. And it got in the way sometimes when I was trying to get day labor jobs early on, because, you know, they would see a female. And when they would take me on the jobs, they would almost do it like it was funny. And were then just completely shocked when I could lift heavy objects and move a refrigerator with my legs. And wow. They were just like, blink, blink, blink. Like, how do I integrate all of this together? But you are female. And you'd think it wouldn't be so extreme in a country where all of the young women are soldiers, too. But it really was. People underestimated my sheer physicality all the time.
Hmm. You know, did you experience any violence against yourself at this point in the story?
It depends on how you define it.
I'm sure.
Like, so I hadn't gotten picked up for a job for a few days one time, and I ended up, through a series of bad decisions, going out to dinner with someone just because I was really hungry. Honestly, it's the only reason I did it. Halfway through the meal, my logic came back online and I started to realize, like, oh man, he's going to expect the sexes. Like, shit. And I was like, oh my God, how am I going to get out of this situation? And so, you know, afterwards I was, you know, he was like walking me back to the hostel and we were walking on the beach and he clearly decided like now was the time. And he grabbed my arm to kind of like throw me to the sand in a manly fashion. But again, he didn't perceive that I had like 40 pounds on him, right? So, you know, he grabs my arm and then like nothing happens. And so then there's this whole new situation where I felt like, do you know when a kid is trying to wrestle with you and you're holding their forehead and their arms are just swinging under your arm trying to get at you? And it kind of felt like that. You're just doing this terribly. You know, that's the only time in my life. Like I was just standing there while he was just tugging on my arm and the whole thing just felt so ridiculous to me that I actually just popped him in the nose and ran away. And he was so shocked. I don't think I effectively punched because I didn't know how to punch, but he was so shocked that a female person was punching him that I think he just kind of dropped his grip on me and I just fled. I just ran back to the hostel. And it was kind of interesting afterwards. I was in the hostel common room and I was telling a bunch of the guys there that I knew what had happened and they just were roaring with laughter.
Did he ever come around again?
He was in from out of town and there was this phenomenon that would happen in some of the small towns that were extremely conservative. Sometimes men, single men, would come into the city for business purposes or, you know, market purposes. And oftentimes when these like country boys came into town, it was like, I'm in the big city. And you'd be surprised. I mean, the number of times I saw men with hookers and blow kind of just having a great time in the city. And so he was like a country rube, you know, kind of like thinking he was going to find a Western hooker, you know? Which is, I assume, kind of what he thought I was.
Right. But he didn't offer you money.
No, he didn't. But I think he might have genuinely thought that like a plate of pasta was the price of an American whore.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So you escaped his grip rather easily.
I didn't feel threatened. I felt almost embarrassed for him. I really did. Looking back with different eyes that I have much different eyes now than I did at the time. You know, at the time I was just like, oh God, you suck at this. Like.
And so at this point you run back to the hostel and you're still in the mindset, well, Tel Aviv is still my home for the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That didn't change a thing. It did not change a thing.
Were you in contact with your family back home?
Well, you know, my mother was very, very unstable and delusional. And my father had been dead for, you know, many, many years at that point. So I didn't have, I had brothers, siblings who were not pleased with me, but I didn't contact them enough to really get much in the way of their disapproval. I just disappeared. Which, hey, turns out later I find out that when you flee the country and no one knows where you are, they don't like that and are displeased with you when you return.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it follows, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Turns out that's not a nice thing to do.
But that means they care, right?
Yeah.
At one point then, I guess you decide to make an upgrade in your employment. Mm-hmm. So another opportunity came along?
Yeah, so one of the hostel dwellers told me to go down to a bar on the beach, and it was a tourist bar, and he said they're hiring. So I walked down to the bar, and, you know, I'm thinking, like, I need to go to a web cafe and, like, print a resume or something, right? But I walk into the bar, and the manager on duty, you know, I say, hey, I heard you might be hiring, and he just looked at me, and he said, turn around. And I was like, okay. And I just, like, slowly turned around.
Okay.
And then after I had done a 360, he said, come back tomorrow. And that was it. I was hired. That's how I got my job.
Gosh. Okay. So yeah. You're objectified.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, within 10 seconds of your application for the job. And
it was all a bunch
And then you're hired.
Yeah. Then I was hired.
Okay.
Yep.
So do you see an increase in your pay at this point?
Oh, my God. It's tremendous. I mean, it would be considered poverty wages now. But at the time in my life, I was like, oh, my God, 100 shekels. Like, I can buy a meal. Like, I can get an apartment. I eventually got an apartment. Oh, my God, what a luxury, you know?
Well, I mean, that's a giant upgrade from sleeping on the beach.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, good for you. So you must have been pretty happy. And, you know, maybe that was even validating your decision to live there.
You know, you keep talking about decisions.
I'm so sorry. Shall I rephrase? Let me rephrase. This yeah. validates the... Okay, I'm going to come up with something. Okay.
No,
let me try. I really want to try.
Okay, you bring it.
Okay. Perhaps, Marie, this validates your living in Tel Aviv.
Maybe it does.
Okay.
I will say this. I definitely found connections and relationships there that felt very needed at the time. I especially bonded with one of the managers there, Klaus, and he was also a very troubled man. He was much older than me, and he'd been in the French Foreign Legion, and he was involved in kind of crimes and things that I didn't really perceive or understand at the time. But for whatever reason, he sort of took one look at me and was like, I am going to protect this one. Like, this one is going to die without protection, which was probably not an unreasonable thing for him to think.
He plays the role of your guardian angel in a way,
yeah.
Self-appointed.
He kind of does, okay. Very much so, actually. Okay. Yeah, he looked after me in my stupidity, bumbling through this incredibly dangerous situation with no knowledge of the kinds of dangers that I was in.
And how did you feel about him taking you under your wing? Did you accept it?
Absolutely. I felt connected to him right away, the same way he felt connected to me right away.
Okay.
And one thing that we discovered, all of the girls and I that worked at the bar, we were sitting around talking after shift one day, and we just discovered through casual discussion of our backstories that every single girl who worked at the bar happened to be fatherless. And it was one of those life moments where I was like, well, this isn't a coincidence. You know, I know it seems like one, but it can't really be, you know?
Right.
Klaus was sort of a paternal figure to me, but it wasn't quite as simple as that. There was also like attraction and electricity between us that we never acted on. But we never acted on it because he would have considered it dishonorable to take advantage of me, because I think he saw me as so pathetic.
And did he have, a girlfriend or a wife?
He had ladies who showed up and went away.
Okay. So,
yeah.
As I said, he's your self-appointed guardian angel. And
yeah, absolutely.
You've accepted him for the position.
Yes, yes.
And you have kind of a romantically charged relationship that you're not acting on, but there's an energy there.
Exactly, yeah. There is an energy there, yeah. And he was very, very troubled. He was as troubled as I was. You know, his backstory, I think, was grimmer than mine by a long shot. He had been a soldier in the French Foreign Legion, and he was involved in all sorts of activities that I think exposed him to things that were contrary to his nature, like murder and death and war and violence and destruction. And I think that if life had dealt him a different hand, he should have been like an artist or a high school teacher. You know what I mean? His disposition was actually very gentle, but he had been trained from his youth to be very violent.
Would it be correct to say that you both helped each other?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was a part of it, is that we were sort of a balm to each other. For him, I think he got to be gentle with me, and he got to be non-exploitative. He got to be honorable. And those were all things he desperately wanted to be.
So while he was a calm in the storm for you,
yeah,
you were also a calm in the storm for him.
Absolutely. I think it definitely went both ways. I have a very powerful image of him. There was this song that was really popular that year, and it was just this kind of this woman singing over and over the line, "I want to be forgiven, I want to be forgiven, I want to be forgiven." And I just have this memory of seeing him when that song came on, and it just like hit a note with him, and watching him stare into his shot glass.
Oh gosh.
Mm-hmm. And sort of like ruminating on that song, I could just see how much pain he was in. And I think that was very powerful for him to be seen in that way.
You said that he had been involved in criminal activities.
Yeah.
And what kinds of things, you know, was he up to? I mean, he had a job at the bar, yeah, but I guess he was supplementing his income.
It's more that the bar itself was sort of a criminal enterprise.
How so?
Well, I came to understand this by degrees. There was one day when I was carrying a tray of empty glasses into the kitchen, and I walked into the kitchen, and the bar owner, Ari, was just beating the living shit out of some poor soul.
Good Lord. Somebody who worked there?
I didn't know the man. And I just backed slowly out of the kitchen and just sort of set the tray down and kind of mechanically went about my business. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now. There was another day where Ari closed down the bar and asked me to wait on this table of very well-dressed men who were very gracious to me and then ended up tipping me like a week's wages.
Score.
Yeah, I know. I was like, sweet. Like, mobsters are great tippers. You know. But again, I was so oblivious. I was so young and so stupid. And there are so many things that I only came to understand later. I was like, oh, when those police would come and take money, that was payment for whatever grift was going on. And okay, like, I understand now. Okay, I'm getting it. I'm getting it.
So there's a lot going on at this bar.
Oh, there was. Yeah, I was just swimming through it at the time without really understanding it.
You saw a policeman on the take there, taking money for whatever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
They weren't too clandestine about it.
No,
no. You know, you're witnessing it.
Well, I think the government had other things to think about. And organized crime there at that time, it was just business. The actual official government was focused on the war.
What a life.
Yeah, it was really weird.
Yeah. Tell me about the time that Klaus came to your rescue.
Oh, whew. Yeah, I don't know if rescue is exactly what I would call it.
Okay.
But we'll find out. Let's see what you think.
Okay, let's see. Also ahead, a surprise visit changes the trajectory of Marie's life. Stay with me. In the final chapter, the currents in Marie's life unite to draw her story to an unexpected conclusion. It's a surprise she did not see coming.
I had seen so much of his softer side, which is what I think he needed to have seen. And he didn't really like me seeing his violent side. But there was one day at the bar where one of the bar patrons I was serving at a table reached out and grabbed my breast, tried to like stick his hand all the way down my shirt, and I shoved him away. I mean, I'd like to say that this is a terrible, rare thing, but waitresses all know it's not, right?
Well, it's still terrible. Maybe not as rare as it should be.
Yeah, but it happened right in front of Klaus. And I've never seen like a soldier in action before. And so I wasn't really prepared for just like the sheer physicality he suddenly snapped into. And he like side vaulted over the bar, had the guy in a neck hold before I even knew what was happening, and then dragged him out in front of the building, and then just kind of came back in a little bit later like nothing had happened.
And were there other people in the bar at the time? Did people witness
this? There were. No one paid a bit of attention. Gosh. I mean, I can't even tell you. Like, so there was one night where a knife fight broke out in my section, and I was carrying three beers, you know, in the three beer waitress carry. And I just jumped up onto the table nearest by while they sorted it all out. Klaus dragged the aggressor out, who owed me money on a tab. And Klaus just came in with the guy's wallet and said, you know, take what you're owed. And then I took some money out, and then he took the wallet back out front. And I was like, okay.
I mean, you're taking your life in your hands every night you go to work.
Well, that's certainly how it seems now, doesn't it?
Yeah. In a word.
But at the time, everyone around me was doing the exact same thing. And we creatures as humans, we are oriented to do what everyone else is doing, you know?
So Klaus has taken one guy out for a beatdown who did you wrong, and I guess dragged another guy out for another beatdown who owed you some money.
Yeah, absolutely. We've established that he was willing to be violent as part of this role that he had taken on as my guardian.
How'd you feel about that?
I think at the time, I was so drawn to being protected that sense of comfort overwhelmed any other qualm I might have had about what was going on. You know, this was half my life ago, and now I look back with horror at some of this. But at the time, I was just like, I'm in chaos. I'm good at chaos. I've never really been protected. I have a protector. And the whole thing was just satisfying some like need in my psyche.
I would think it would be very comforting.
It was. It was extremely comforting. And even the violence in its way was comforting because I was like, he'll protect me from anything. And he can.
Right.
And he's ferocious. He's fierce, yeah. You know?
So at this point in your story, you've left the chaos of home in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, looking for something that was more comfortable for you. In Europe.
Yeah.
You find yourself in Tel Aviv during the Second Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
There's violence around you. You've had some pretty hard jobs.
Yeah.
You found some level of safety and comfort in a friendship,
mm-hmm.
and some normalcy in that you have a regular job and a paycheck that will give you the basic necessities of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, Marie, we've now come to the night that is your secret.
Yeah.
So there's a barfly, right?
Yes.
That is a regular at the bar.
Yes, Ben, there was.
And what was his name?
His name was Yosef. Yosef was a type that I think is familiar to anyone who has worked in the bar and restaurant industry. He was the barfly, aging alcoholic, came in just about every night and drank all night long and stumbled home late. Just every single day, Yosef was an Israeli, and he was just kind of a weather-beaten older man, probably in his 60s.
Kind of a harmless dude.
Yeah, like a harmless dude. You know, I think we were the closest things to friends he had. You know, I think that's why he came every single night.
Did he have a job that you knew of?
I think he had a day job, and he came after work and he drank until bedtime every single day. And I think he had pretty young girls who were sweet to him and brought him things and teased him and were friendly.
Yeah, it was his social life.
That was his social life. Yeah, that was his reality. And I think I, at least, and I don't know if I can speak for all of the girls, but I thought of him kind of like Santa Claus, you know? He was just this jolly older man with a red nose, like a drunken Santa Claus, kind of, you know, sort of just a benevolent spirit.
Okay, your heart went out to him a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're kind of comfortable with his presence there. You get used to him because he's there all the time.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Did you talk to him much?
I talked to him when it was slow and when it was quiet. We just talked about this and that and the other. But there was this one night when he said something, he made some comment, and I followed up. And it turns out Yosef is super into artificial intelligence. And I was like, what the what? I hadn't had a conversation about my field of study since I left school.
Whoa, hold on. This is your field of study.
I know.
At the criminal bar.
I know, right? And I, is it right? I'm surrounded by soldiers and gangsters and all this craziness. And he's like talking to me about this something from my old life, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
And he had no idea that this would strike a chord with you.
No, not at all. Not until I started grilling him about it. Okay. And then we started like nattering to each other and arguing with each other. And, you know, we had very different opinions about kind of black box AI. And we started arguing about Marvin Minsky, right?
Okay. One of the fathers of computer science.
Yes. And I was very, when it came to artificial intelligence, I was very anti-Minsky and he was very pro-Minsky. But I hadn't read one of Minsky's books from the 80s. So Yosef kind of just like slaps his hand on the bar and he's like, well, you have to read it. I have a copy at my apartment and I'm going to insist that you read it, you know?
Okay.
What time do you get off work?
Wow, what a come on. This is a way to get a girl to your house?
No. And it's funny, like, I can't even express to you how deeply I saw him as a non-sexual being at the time.
Sure. No, I totally get it. He's Santa Claus.
He's Santa Claus. He's three times my age, you know?
Yeah.
And again, there was this lure of, oh, God, I haven't. There's not a computer science section at the only English language bookstore in my neighborhood, right? It's not like these books are easy to come by. And again, I don't know. It was like this siren song. It was like, oh, my God, I'm going to read a Minsky book. It's like old times.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, you're connecting on an intellectual plane that you excel at, that you have not been able to exercise.
Yeah, yeah. I was really good at it, too. I was doing some papers back then that I look back and they would have been publishable if I'd been sane enough to try and publish them, you know?
Okay, so he lays down this offer, like, come on over to my pad and we'll read Minsky together.
Yeah.
Were alarm bells going off in Marie's brain, or were you just like,
yeah, let's go. It sounds so stupid now, like, but every woman knows about this. Looking back and going, why the fuck did I do that? What the fuck was I thinking? You know, because every woman has to learn that you can't do stuff like that.
Okay, right? So I take it this is a learning moment for you.
This was very much a learning moment for me. So we walk back to his apartment and we walk up and go inside. And I don't even wait for him to show me around. I just like make a beeline for his bookshelf. And I'm like, oh my God, blah, 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 blah. And I am just scanning through the books, talking about them. And I find the Minsky book and I grab it. And then I turn around and Yosef has gotten naked.
You turn around and he's buck naked.
He got naked. He is buck naked. And I could just see his penis poking out from under his belly.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was sort of transfixed by it for a second. Okay. Like, oh, my God. Like, what is happening? And I think this, I have this curiosity about what Yosef's life was like when he was young. That he thought, like, the first move you make with a lady is to just take
naked.
Off all your clothes. Get naked.
Right. So he hadn't whispered sweet nothings to you.
No.
Hadn't bought you a drink at the bar.
No.
He hadn't even tried to give you a peck on the cheek.
Nope. Just drop trowel.
Just naked. Like, okay. Here I am.
Yeah, I'm just naked. Okay. Just here I am.
Wow.
But it makes a little more sense if you realize what I realized, which is at that moment, I was like, oh, he is drunk. Right? He is drunk. And I didn't realize how drunk he was.
I want to ask you a question. So we're laughing about this, right? Do we call this assault?
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't feel assaulted.
Okay.
I think... sexual misconduct, shall we call it? The thing is, I don't know what would have happened. I don't know what he had in mind. And in actuality, what he said.
I think I know what he had in mind.
He wanted his Willie to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. It is one truism of life that there is nothing as hopeful as an erection, right? Correct.
That is true.
It is sort of the physical embodiment of hope. So, and I think at the time what he said as he kind of lurched in my direction was, I love you. I think I love you. And I was like, what? Like, sweet nothings after your penis is out? Like, so I just kind of like hopped to the side out of his way and I ran just out of the apartment and down. You know, running away is a theme I'm discovering in my in my stories about that time. Yeah.
So you didn't have to pop Yosef in the nose.
No, no, he never had the agility to make physical contact with me at all.
Okay, good.
Now, on the scale of bad things in my life, Yosef does not rate. he's a blink, you know?
Sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it down the stairs and I thought it was fucking hilarious, right? I thought it was so fucking funny. I was like laughing into my fist, thinking like, what the fuck just happened?
So did you have the book with you? Did you?
I did. That was really so funny. Is that okay. I still had the book and I was like, well, I'm not giving it back.
Hey, I think you earned it.
I was like, yeah, I think I earned this book. So I just took it home. And I was like, yeah, I have a Mitski book now. That was my big takeaway. Is that like, yeah, I have a book.
All right, good. So you made your way back home.
Yep, made my way back home.
Did you just go home and just open up the book and start reading?
Yeah, I just went home and I read the whole thing cover to cover. Yeah. I was just so hungry for that kind of thinking and that kind of conversation.
You know, what happens the next day? Does he come back in?
No. And this is what is so interesting. Let me say, when I came back to the bar, because of my mindset, the very first thing I did was I went to all of the girls and I was like, oh my God, you will not believe what Yosef did. Like, you can't, let me tell you. And they were all just like, oh, shock, horror, you know? And that was the last time I ever saw Yosef. He never came back again.
So you're thinking at that point, gee, you know, he's embarrassed. Whatever, you know, he can't face you again after this humiliating evening.
I think so.
Yeah. So he's just feeling humiliated. He doesn't come back.
But I do remember that he got attacked on the street a little while later. Like, I heard about it, like badly attacked on the streets of Tel Aviv. And he was beaten very severely. Violence was so commonplace there that it didn't really register with me. And I was like, oh, poor Yosef. And the girls even passed around a card for him. Like, oh, we hope you feel better soon, Yosef. But he almost died. And I remember hearing people talking about him. Like, he didn't regain consciousness for a while and having to get MRIs.
Oh, my God.
Like,
but you never heard ultimately what his health was after that attack.
No, I didn't. I never talked to him again, you know.
And so how much longer are you in Tel Aviv at this point?
Probably another 4 or 5 months or so, maybe. It was actually the day that I left Tel Aviv that Klaus finally kissed me, putting me on a plane. And we just kissed one time. And it was a goodbye kiss.
There was just some acknowledgement.
Yeah, exactly.
Did it feel terribly bittersweet?
Yeah, it was bittersweet, but it was exciting and it was beautiful and it was terribly sad.
Did you feel that you'd missed out on something?
No.
You know, do you feel like you should have had a relationship with
him? No, no. And, you know, I totally would have, you know, I totally would have if he had initiated. But there was something very powerful in the fact that he didn't.
Sounds to me like that's what you needed.
That's what I needed. Absolutely. I spent so much time, you know. Sometimes as a young woman, it feels like you're just fending off people trying to stick things in you. And you're like, you know, just having someone who doesn't try was actually precious. It was more precious to me than if we had consummated, I think.
What a beautiful relationship.
It was. It was an incredibly beautiful relationship.
I'm sure you look back on it fondly.
I do. I do.
You're not in touch with him these days, are
you? No, no. We exchanged emails for a while, but the language barrier made that surprisingly difficult way to communicate. And, you know, there was no texting, there was no video chat. It just sort of faded away. We couldn't really connect over email the way that we had. It didn't mean the same thing.
So 5 months passed. Mm-hmm. What was it that made you come to the, I'm going to assume this is now a decision.
Yeah.
Come to the decision to leave and go back home.
My oldest friend and my first boyfriend back in the States came and got me.
Oh, they came and got you?
Yeah, came and got me. He was like, you're going home.
Wow. This is like an intervention of the hugest kind.
Yeah, it was an intervention. It's like 1 year in a war zone is enough, young lady. You're coming home.
Wow. So you were there a solid 12 months, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
What a year.
What a fucking year, you know? It was my oldest friend, my first boyfriend from high school, actually.
Did you know that he was coming to get you?
No. He showed up on my birthday.
How did he find you?
I'd been in touch with him enough and been sharing my adventures with him much more than with my family, because my family situation was a lot more fraught. And he was a kind of universally positive friend and connection and someone that I loved very, very dearly. So I felt a little more free to kind of, I didn't feel as angsty sharing with him my adventures.
This is amazing. And so your ex high school boyfriend, who you're still friends with,
yeah,
shows up in Tel Aviv at work.
Yeah.
On your birthday.
On my birthday.
Did he plan that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Your mouth must have just been agape, jaw on the floor. You probably just couldn't believe it was him when he shows up.
I couldn't. And there's another detail here that there's a whole nother series of stories here. But he actually brought my mother.
Oh my God. And were they both there?
I don't know if he was sure I was going to go with him if he just came. So he came and brought my mother.
But your mom is broken and desperate and not a great caretaker. But she made this trip to save you also.
Yeah. So my mother's a complicated figure, right? She was crazy, but she loved me passionately, very, very much.
I can't even imagine.
But was very, very broken.
Wow.
Herself.
What time of day is it when they show up?
I was starting evening shift, so it was probably like 4 or 5 in the afternoon, early evening, and they were like, surprise!
Happy birthday!
Yeah, happy birthday! Guess what? You're going home! And between the two of them, the force of their insistence was like, okay. And it was the first time that I hadn't seen anyone from home in a year. And so this sense of reality kind of hit me of like, no, I got to go back to my life. This, like, whatever I'm fleeing, I have to go back to. And I didn't really want to.
Okay. So this was also not a decision.
Yeah. They were the strongest force in my life at that moment. And so I followed. And also Klaus was in on it because he wanted me to leave.
But how did they get in touch with Klaus to lure him into their scheme?
I don't remember now. It must have been over email. I think Klaus was with me at an internet cafe one time while I was emailing my friend. It's hard to remember some details like that now because this was like, you know, more than 20 years ago at this point, right? So I think that he kind of like jumped on the keyboard and kind of wormed his way into contact with them.
Wow, Marie, my heart is breaking. Do you know why?
Why?
Because this is such a love story. I mean, Klaus loved you enough to let you go.
Yeah.
And to actively work for that.
Yeah, yeah. And to conspire to make it happen.
He knew if you knew he were up to that, you'd probably find a way out of it.
I might have even disappeared again.
Exactly.
You know, and he knew me well enough to know that.
Wow. I am just so touched at his selflessness.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long were your mother and your ex-boyfriend in town for? Did you, you know, take them to the beach and show them around?
Yeah. Showed him the sights. Like, what do you do when you got people in from out of town?
Right.
You know, we did like the Holy Land trip.
Gosh.
Which, you know, a lot of it was shut off. You can go everywhere because of the war, but we, you know.
Okay.
We kind of did the tourist thing for like a week.
Goodness gracious. Okay, great.
I know.
Amazing. Okay, so they already had a ticket for you?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So you knew your date that you were going to leave.
The whole thing was planned.
So they airlifted you out of Tel Aviv.
They did. They airlifted me out of Tel Aviv with an assist from my ferocious protector on the ground.
From Klaus.
Yeah.
And there's still more story.
There is.
So you find yourself on the plane.
Yeah.
You have a goodbye embrace and kiss with Klaus.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very powerful, like, act of love for them to come and get me, too. Like, you know, it was...
Oh, very.
Getting into the country wasn't, like, super easy and fun at the time. Like, they were not encouraging people to come be tourists.
Do they have to arrange this with the State Department?
No, because travel was never banned. But, you know, they had to go through the LL desperate security measures, and you know that people are almost disbelieving when you land.
Like, what are you doing here?
What are you doing here? Like, yeah. Why are you, you know, naive shikso? Like, what the fuck are you doing here?
We're on a rescue mission. We're on a rescue mission.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Right. Yeah, right, exactly. We're on a rescue mission.
So we're at the airport. You get on the plane. How does it feel, you know, sitting down in that airplane with your mother and your ex-boyfriend who have come to rescue you? I mean, are you overjoyed? Are you shameful? You know, what are your emotions?
Well, it's kind of hard to articulate. It turns out, like, going to live in a war zone doesn't, like, fix your mental illness.
Okay.
So
do tell.
It doesn't, like, make it all better. But I did come to, like, really understand over the years what Klaus had done for me. And I came to see a lot of his actions differently as well.
Give me an example.
Well, there was one night, like, probably sometime in my 30s, I think. It took me this long to realize I was sitting with a girlfriend. And something we ladies do sometimes is we drink wine and we share the sexual harassment stories of our youth. And I told the story of Yosef just the way I told it to you. Like, it was so fucking funny, like, you know, giggling. And and my girlfriend asked me, she said, well, did you give him back the book?
Good question.
And I was like, no, I never saw him again. And I started to explain. And I was like, no, you know, actually, yeah, no, he got beaten. And as I was talking, it felt like there was like this row of dominoes lined up in my head, right? And they just started to tip one after another after another. And I was like, he got beaten badly.
Okay.
And I had this memory come back to me of the day that I went back to the bar and told the girls my story. And I remember Klaus coming up to me and just like almost rough, much more than he'd ever been with me, kind of grabbing my arm and saying, I heard the girls talking. That thing with Yosef, is that true?
Oh my God.
And I was like, oh, Klaus, yes, but don't be like, it's not, if he was silly, you know, he was drunk. I was not in any danger. Everything is fine. Like, I swear, I promise, like, cross my heart and hope to die. Like, everything's fine. You don't need to worry.
We know what Klaus is capable of.
Well, that's just it, right? And he just kind of like nodded his head and he just turned on his heel and he walked away. And he and I never spoke of it again. But as I was telling the story all these years later, I thought to myself, like, oh my fucking God. Klaus did that to Yosef.
Wow.
Because of me.
Wow. He's beating everybody that crosses your path, man.
I know. And I was just, and I was horrified, A, that it happened, B, that I didn't realize.
Yeah.
I mean, Yosef almost died.
Gosh.
Because of me is, well, sort of how it felt.
I mean, okay. So let's explore that a little bit.
Yeah.
And may I say, Klaus, such a complicated character. It's, you know, capable of such violence and such tenderness.
I know.
But so you said...
Yeah.
Possibly you said it with a little question mark at the end, but I want to ask you. You said that Yosef almost died because of you.
Yeah.
And is that how you feel, that it was because of you?
I don't know. I mean... it's one of those situations that all these years later, it's hard to know how to feel. Yeah. But that's what my initial reaction was like, oh my God, I should have kept my mouth shut. Like, how stupid was I? I should have.
Well, maybe he should have kept his clothes on.
Well, yeah, that's the other part of it. Yeah. Maybe he should have kept his clothes on. This is the thing, is that something that, again, I understand much better now is that Ari must have been a pretty powerful man based on everything I saw. And it must have been a kind of a known thing that you don't fuck with his girls, right? In a very paternalistic way, not in a sexual way, right?
Well, Ari's busy beating people, too.
Well, yeah, Ari's got his whole thing going on. He doesn't have time for a silly gaggle of girls who sling drinks at his bar. So I think about Yosef and I think, well, you were Israeli. You've lived there your whole life. Like, how did you not know? Like, I know how I didn't know. But how did you not know that you were crossing a major line, not just as like a person to another person, but like in the power structure surrounding you?
Right. Well, he was drunk, like off his ass.
He was drunk. He was drunk. And I don't think he'd ever had a conversation about science with a female bodied person before, you know? He said, like, I love you. And I was like, that's not what's happening right now. But I think he, in his mind, was just, whatever he was feeling was powerful enough for him to cast all that aside. That or he was just drunk, you know? I don't know.
Is there a part of you that still feels it's your fault? Because I'm going to say it's not.
Here's the part of it that I'm not proud of.
Okay.
When I went to tell my story to the other girls in the bar, on the one hand, there was an aspect of that was like, you know, everyone should know who to watch out for. You know, everyone should know who's prone to getting their penises out when they're doing this line of work. And so I should tell them. But I also was kind of making fun of him at the time because I thought it was so pathetic and so funny. That kind of hamming it up storytelling posture that I had when I was telling the girls what happened feels very childish and stupid in light of what happened to him. So I think that's it, is it's the frivolity of my blithely walking through this world with no understanding of what was going on around me and no understanding of the consequences and not really making choices. And that's the part of it that I look back and think, like, I am so not proud of that girl.
Well, I think we can safely say that the punishment outweighed the crime.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. At the very least, like, the punishment outweighed the crime.
Yeah, and so you feel some responsibility for
I do.
The level of the punishment that was meted out.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I don't think that is a burden you need to bear.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, you did not start the chain of events.
Yeah, I didn't start the war, that's for sure.
That is for sure. Well, Marie, what a story. I think that's your secret, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's my secret.
Goodness gracious. Why did you want to tell your story today?
I think I'm starting to think about myself and my life and telling my story a little differently than I have in the past. And I think part of that, honestly, is listening to your podcast and thinking about what value there is in stories. And I feel like these stories that I have of my encounters with masculinity in Tel Aviv are stories in which, to some extent or another, I triumphed over these events. You know, these events didn't touch me, and these men were not powerful over me. Even in just the physical way, I was coming into, like, the power of my adult female body in the sense that I was not vulnerable in the way that I had been, and that a lot of my vulnerability was in my mind. And that was a real shift. And I don't know if I ever could have made that shift if I hadn't grown to be 6 feet tall. I don't know how 5 foot tall women walk through this world. Like, people can pick them up, you know, like, it's terrible.
Right.
So there was this sense of, and to me, there's some value, and I'm hoping that folks can find some sense of recognition in that we're not as helpless necessarily as we feel. And sometimes that helplessness is a reaction to something else and not to the actual circumstances.
Well, I think that is an excellent lesson and something that I think a lot of people will take from your story.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for listening to me.
How could I not?
Marie's story is one of triumph, one that took her on a journey not only to a dangerous foreign land, but through battles with mental health. She navigated treacherous waters with only her inner demons shining as her guiding light. And our self-described
21-year-old dipshit
will be the first to admit that people will have different takes on her story. Regardless, she's living her own truth and is a survivor. And she would be the first to say that her survival is thanks not only to her own inner strength, but also to the love of others. And Marie shared pictures.
There's a place that you'll see there called Shuka Carmel, which is a market, and my apartment was right over top of that market.
You'll want to see where Marie secured her apartment.
I can pull up my Tel Aviv album. I think there's one I'm thinking of right now that's like Ari standing with all of the girls around him.
Okay, great.
I've got it right now. Yeah, I'll share this one with you and you can see the kind of place it was. So yeah, I will send you some pictures from this album.
Fantastic.
And there's also a picture of Marie on the beach she called home.
Exactly. Yeah.
See Marie's story come to life right now on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Secret Room Pod. On the next Secret Room Unlocked, Marie shares some candid thoughts about today's interview and tells me what she's up to today.
Also, Ben's guest Rachel from our last episode, Was Any of It Real?, joins me for part two of her story. Hear how a real-world Drew entered her life and how she balanced him with the reckoning of the fake Drew she fell in love with years earlier. And keeping the catfish theme alive, Ben and I will share several catfish stories you all sent after hearing the episode, and I will even share my own catfish tale.
The next Secret Room Unlocked drops in a week for members who support at patreon.com/secretroom. Do you have a pedantic secret to share? Well, consider all your options and then submit to the show at our website. Today's podcast was made by Susie Lark, Luna Patel, Alessandra Nigro, JB, the Street Secret Team, and Marco. Our music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. It was produced in Cypress and Pearland, Texas. If you love The Secret Room, please support our sponsors. Check our website or the show notes in your podcast player for their generous offers. And we've come to the end of the podcast for today. Are you left wanting another taste? We'll be back in 2 weeks. Bring your fork, because you are going to want to devour it. See you then.
This is The Secret Room, a podcast about the stories no one ever tells.
I'm Ben Hamm.
And then we have this little sign-off we do at the end of the show.
Yes, I know. I'm familiar.
Oh, you're familiar.
I've listened all the way to the end of more than one of your episodes.
So you're the person who listens this far.
Right?
So here we go.
Pot on, Marie.
Pot on, Ben.